Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. How has business in Ferguson been impacted by last year's turmoil and by more recent demonstrations? We'll talk about that a little bit later in the program. But first, by any standard, Missouri Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill has a success story to tell. A prosecutor, state legislator, state auditor, and she is one of the more high-profile members of the U.S. Senate. She's documented her career in a new memoir, a book designed to motivate women that includes the message, "Don't be afraid to get tough and get your hands dirty to achieve goals." The book is titled Plenty Ladylike, written with former Post-Dispatch reporter Terry Gainey. Senator McCaskill joins us from NPR in Washington to talk about the book and some of the other things people are discussing inside and outside of Washington these days. Senator, thanks so much for being with us.
It's great to be with you, Don.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that people are talking about before we get to the book. First on my list is Hillary Clinton's email problems. You're a big supporter of Hillary Clinton. How damaging do you think these latest revelations are?
Well, if you separate the facts from the political attack, this is certainly not a huge problem. I think she said she would do it differently if she had to do it over, but she has turned over the emails. In fact, she turned over so many emails that the State Department has sent her back thousands of emails saying, no, these are personal. She's now said, look at the server. There's no indication whatsoever that she ever moved classified information in any email that she received or sent. The information may have been classified at a later date, but at the moment in time that it was sent, there was not a problem. And at the end of the day, I'm trying to figure, what do people think she was trying to do? Was she trying to undermine the United States? Was she trying to make sure that China could get secret information? Of course not. I think she made a mistake in terms of wanting to protect some of her personal information. But I think she's certainly been more than forthcoming, voluntarily come in front of these congressional hearings that sometimes feel like a witch hunt, and is volunteering to come forward again. So I think in the long run, most voters will see this for what it is, which is primarily a political attack.
Well, her critics are saying, and probably will say for the months ahead, given all that's going to be going on in connection with the emails, that there is a major trust issue here, and that ultimately will be damaging.
Well, trust in what regard? That she was doing things to hurt the United States? That she was there's no indication of that. Absolutely no indication of that. So I think that right now it's hard because everyone is attacking Hillary Clinton. And we don't know who among the cast of thousands will be the Republican nominee. Once a nominee emerges for the Republicans, and once I hope that Hillary Clinton gets the Democratic nomination, we will be in a position to compare and contrast two views of America, two sets of policies, who's going to fight for the middle class. And in all those comparisons, I think Hillary Clinton will come out on top.
Moving along to Donald Trump, your take on his performance and what's going on with him. What does that tell us about him and about American politics?
Well, I don't respect Donald Trump, but I certainly respect the voters that are saying they want him to win because I understand that they are so frustrated with government that they want someone who will really shake it up. And they have a sense that Donald Trump is that kind of personality. I do think, though, it's important to keep context here. While there may be 20 to 25% of the Republican primary voters that are saying they support Donald Trump, that means 75 to 80% of the primary voters are rejecting him. And they all know who he is. They all know what he stands for. Well, I'm not sure anybody knows what he stands for because he doesn't ever get into specifics. He just says things like, we're going to be great and China's terrible and the Mexicans are terrible, build a wall. He doesn't ever give any substance to his policy pronouncements. It's almost like he's surfing across people's emotional touchstones as opposed to trying to hit things that people are angry about, as opposed to really putting forth a plan on how he would lead this country. So I said yesterday to a group of people, I am really pretty darn confident that Donald Trump will not be president of the United States. I'm pretty confident he will not be the Republican nominee. But if he is, I think the Democratic nominee will have a much easier time.
It would seem to indicate that a lot of American people are fed up with politicians, that's why someone like this emerges as he has.
All the quote-unquote outsiders are doing well. And I perfectly I understand that sentiment. I'm there. I'm trying. It's very hard to get compromises done. It's very hard to pull people in from the edges. And frankly, Donald Trump's rhetoric doesn't help that, because the solutions to our problems lie in compromise, not in rigid ideology that doesn't acknowledge that the other side might have a point. And that's really what's wrong with Washington. It's not that people are, quote unquote, on the take or people don't care. It's that not enough people are willing to compromise.
You point out in your book, Plenty Ladylike, that your friend, Mr. Schumer, is and a good friend of yours. We all know that he now has indicated he's going to vote against the Iran deal. Have you made up your mind yet?
I have not. The Republicans insisted that we get 60 days to look at the deal. It appeared to me most of them made up their mind in 5 minutes. But I'm taking as much time as I need, and I'm doing the following. I'm contacting the ambassadors from the countries that hold Iran's money that has been denied to them because of the sanctions. This is not the United States. It's about $60 billion. It's not, we don't have control of the money. It is Turkey, it is South Korea, Japan, India, and China that primarily have their money. I want to know what they're going to do with the money if we don't do the deal. Are they going to continue to respect the U.S. congressionally applied sanctions? These would not be United Nations sanctions. This would be our unilateral secondary sanctions. Would they continue to voluntarily cooperate with that? Or are they going to begin to do business with Iran? And will that whole sanction thing fray? And the worst possible scenario would be for us not to do this deal, Iran to get the $60 billion, and we have not put cement down their centrifuges. So that's what I'm doing. And once I make the best determination I can in that regard, I'll make a decision on how to vote.
Have you heard from any of them?
I have talked to China. It was not good. China was very clear that they do not intend on recognizing U.S.-imposed sanctions if the United States walks away. So I've got to talk to them. I've talked to the other allies that are part of the deal. I've talked to Great Britain. I've talked to Germany. I've talked to Russia. But I have not yet talked to Japan and India and Turkey and South Korea.
So you're not leaning one way or the other at this point?
Well, if I'm leaning, I'm probably leaning slightly in favor. Just because I think while this deal isn't perfect and there's parts of it I don't like, I think the alternative in terms of the standing of the United States on the world stage and the deterrence of potential military action diminishes. I thought there was a really powerful piece done this morning by former Senator John Warner from Virginia, Republican senator who was chairman of the Armed Services Committee and a World War II veteran, and Carl Levin, the former chair of the Armed Services Committee, a Jewish former senator from Michigan. And they said, from a Hawks perspective, they didn't want us to walk away from the deal because they believed it would make Iran less afraid of a military deterrent, because is it really true that we would have the world united militarily against Iran if they crossed the line, or would it be United States by itself? And I think that's a valid point also.
One other question before we move to the book, and that concerns Planned Parenthood, the discussion over its funding. Is this likely to, do you think, to lead to a government shutdown?
I hope not. I don't think so. I think that Mitch McConnell has indicated he didn't think that was a good idea. Let's fund the government, and then let's debate and vote on funding for Planned Parenthood, or let's debate and vote on funding for Planned Parenthood and then move on to fund the government. But the notion that you can force people to be for an issue that's not directly involved in funding the government by threatening a government shutdown, they tried that once before and it didn't work out very well. So I'll be surprised if that happens this time. And my take on the whole issue is pretty simple. We all want to prevent abortions. It seems a very wrong way to prevent abortions to cut off money for contraception. And that's what this money is. It's not for abortions. It can't be used for abortions. So it seems to me if we want to continue to see the abortion rate go down, which it is in this country, we should support funding for every place that is providing contraception, and certainly Planned Parenthood is one of the major networks in the country that provides family planning services for millions of women.
I noted in the paper the other day that you're promoting an advocacy group for Missouri legislative interns. I'm wondering if that's getting any traction and how much of that is the result of your own experience as a Missouri legislator, which you write about in the book, and which would indicate that some of what we've been reading lately about our legislators' relationship with interns has been most inappropriate.
Yeah, it's so sad to me. I was an intern in 1974. I think that was, what, 40 years ago?
Let's not do that.
Yikes. And I experienced some of the same problems that these young women experienced. And I didn't handle it the same way they did. I did not confront it. I did not turn in the men who had done it. I'm not sure I handled it correctly. But I was very proud. The young lady, one of the young women who came forward, she reached out to my office and asked to visit with me. I called her. We had a great visit. I told her how proud I was of her. These young women coming forward have, I think, done a lot for ending this kind of behavior, because the ultimate deterrent is for people to lose their careers. And both of these gentlemen lost their careers over this inappropriate behavior. So I was very proud of her, and I asked her, what can we do to help other women? And her idea was someplace a young lady can go and get good information to help her make the decision as to whether or not to come forward. So we're going to try to facilitate that kind of resource for young women who are interning in Jeff City.
I think that what most people are talking about who have read your book or heard about it or read excerpts is the Todd Akin aspect of it. And what is particularly interesting is the fact that you admit having manipulated the Republican primary to a degree to ensure that Todd Akin would be your rival because you thought he was the one you could most easily beat. Is manipulated too strong a word to use?
I don't think manipulated is the right word. I think it was high risk and very strategic. And one of the reasons I included the story in this book is I want young women to embrace not just their ambition, not just their strongly held opinions, but also to learn to appreciate the need to be strategic when you're confronting obstacles. What we did was very straightforward. I knew from knowing Todd Akin's record and the record of the other two candidates that he had said and done many things that were outside the mainstream. Principled. This is a man who's very principled. I would never criticize him for trying to play to the cheap seats or being politically manipulative. He was very sincere about what he believed, and he wasn't making any of it up. I knew he would say it, and I knew a lot of those views were not what most Missourians agreed with, like college loans being a form of socialism, like doing away with the school lunch program, like wanting to dismantle Medicare and Social Security, things like that. So I thought he would be the strongest, the weakest opponent for us. So we polled in the Republican primary, determined what they liked about Todd Akin. Todd Akin didn't have a lot of money to run ads, so we cut an ad, and it was very straightforward. I said, this is Claire McCaskill. I approve this message. We reported the expenditure on our report. None of this was behind closed doors or done in secret. I said, I approve the message, and the message was simple. Todd Akin is too conservative, which is what I totally believed. And then I listed the things in the ad that made him too conservative for Missouri. And it happened to be the things that we knew Republican primary voters liked about him. And it worked. First of all, if I was saying he was too conservative, that was a seal of approval for most Republican primary voters. And secondly, they agreed with many of the extreme positions that he embraced. So it actually moved the needle for him, and I think was a big contributing factor to his win in the primary. And I'm not ashamed of it. I think it was strategic. I think it was smart. And I was able to get reelected to the Senate to work for Missourians on the things that, and the values that I hope we all share.
But another thing you wrote in the book was that you reached out to some of those who were close to the Akin campaign, encouraging them to start rerunning a commercial he had been running featuring Mike Huckabee. And I bring that, and they did, but I bring that up because the Washington Post and Politico just this week are suggesting that perhaps that was illegal, making contact with the other side, if you will, and that perhaps the FEC might be interested in that.
I don't know where that comes from, but it's silly. I think it was a Republican right-wing congressman who made the assertion that it was illegal coordination. I gave advice to another candidate. If that is not allowed, then we've got a whole lot of campaign violations going on in America because candidates give advice to other candidates all the time. We didn't share any data with them. We spoke in broad generalities. I wanted to give him some advice. And by the way, I was certainly not confident he was going to take my advice. I mean, I was his opponent. But they did. They took down the ad that they had put up and put the ad by Mike Huckabee back on the air. But it was just as simple as my First Amendment rights to give advice to another candidate, and that's what happened.
So you don't anticipate any contact with the Federal Elections Commission?
Well, I mean, people file complaints all the time just for political purposes. I am confident, 100% confident, that we did nothing inappropriate. Yeah, I think people are frankly upset that. I mean, this may go into the category of sore loser. I'm not sure.
But to Todd Akin, as it turns out, was partially responsible, at least for the title of your book. As I recall, and you point this out in the book, that after a debate with him, he said of you, "She's not very ladylike."
That's right. And it reminded me of when I was in the eighth grade and I had a teacher tell me that I needed to quit speaking so much in class, that boys weren't going to like me. And that it wasn't ladylike. And I loved that teacher, and it hurt my feelings when she said that to me. And, you know, fast forward many years, and here I am as a United States senator in a heated campaign and a pointed debate where I was trying to be very substantive and strong. And I just decided that I wanted to convey in the title of the book that it's plenty ladylike to be assertive and strong.
One of the things you also say in the book is that you want to redefine that word ladylike. How would you like it defined?
I think I would love it if when somebody thought about being ladylike, that it would be strong, successful, outspoken, changing the world. Those are the values I think that we should instill in young women about their femininity, that it's not about being demure and being seen and not heard. It's just the opposite. We need women in every part of our country, whether it's in boardrooms, CEOs, principals, superintendents, U.S. senators, governors, all of it. We need women, more women. I think it makes our country stronger. I think they bring added value to any endeavor. And so I want to encourage with this book. I hope a lot of fathers buy it for their daughters because my father gave me permission. And it was very important because my mom was terrific, and I talk a lot about what my mom meant to me and my career. But my dad was extraordinarily special because he's the one who really gave me permission. He told me, "Don't worry, you know, boys may not like you in high school or college, but eventually they'll figure it out." And he was right.
You know, I mentioned in the introduction that one of the things you say in your book is that at times you have to be tough and you have to get your hands dirty. When do you think you were at your toughest and got your hands dirtiest?
Well, I think that, you know, deciding to risk millions of dollars of my campaign funds to execute a very unconventional strategy in the primary, Republican primary, was certainly one of those moments. I think pulling myself off the couch after losing the race for governor and going after I just defeated an incumbent governor and 2 years later to run against an incumbent U.S. senator, those are two tough things to get done. I certainly, as a young prosecutor, when I was the only young woman in the prosecutor's office and was surrounded by all male judges, all male prosecutors, all male police and detectives, I certainly had to toughen up during those years. But in every instance, I sure learned a lot. And and of course, the sexual harassment stuff when I was young was tough. I don't think people realized when I was laughing with the jokes and acting like I wasn't offended how hurtful a lot of it was. And I go through that in some detail in the book.
Yeah, and that takes us back to the legislative days. We had a note here from Representative Stacey Newman today saying essentially that she went through the same thing that you did. One of the things I noted in watching the Republican debate last week was the fact that, given what's been going on here in Ferguson and all over the country, actually, but particularly here in Ferguson, that there was no discussion amongst the Republican candidates about social justice issues, about racial divisiveness and that sort of thing. Did that surprise you?
It did. There were a lot of things about that debate that surprised me. There were no questions about criminal justice reform and social justice, income inequality. There wasn't even a question about minimum wage, paternity leave, maternity leave. These are all issues that are really important right now, and particularly social justice issues and criminal justice reform. We are beginning to see some green shoots of progress in terms of bipartisan interest in reforming the criminal justice system. We had a hearing called by a Republican chairman of a committee, give credit to the Republican chairman, just a few weeks ago, where we looked at the Bureau of Prisons in the federal system. 95% of the people we hold in the federal prison system are nonviolent. 95% are nonviolent. Only 5% are violent. And we're spending $7 billion a year on that effort. We can do this smarter and better, and we can do it in a way that does not marginalize and minimize the chances that young African-American males have to take their rightful place in their families and communities as God-loving, good Americans who want to participate fully in the American dream. And the reform of the criminal justice system really does have to be an issue that is talked about in this presidential campaign, from my perspective.
And, of course, the president has weighed in on that most recently with his concerns over mandatory minimum sentences and that sort of thing. Where do you stand on that?
I think that mandatory minimum sentences, when I was a prosecutor in Jackson County, I began one of the first drug courts in the country. And I remember calling over to the federal government saying, why don't you send me your low-level drug offenders and we'll put them through our drug court. And, of course, drug court is an opportunity for someone who's nonviolent to get off drugs and to work at it for a while. They don't have to be perfect. They can have a stumble or two as long as they're still trying. And at the end of the drug court, when they graduate, you dismiss the charge against them so they don't have that anchor weighing them down. It's been wildly successful across the country. There are now thousands of drug courts across this country, and the recidivism rate is very low. But the federal system has been very slow to adopt this kind of therapeutic model, and that's something we need to look at, because low-level drug offenses, it is not smart for the taxpayers to put those people, warehouse those people in very expensive bed space. We can instill accountability measures that make them into taxpayers and participating members of their family, and it's a win-win for everybody.
Where do you stand on gun courts? There's a lot of talk about that here, given the sharp increase in gun violence in St. Louis.
I think that a special docket for gun offenses would be fine in St. Louis. At least it would allow them to focus on some of the more problematic folks that are out there. I do know that there is now a really good, robust program going on between the U.S. attorney in St. Louis and the circuit attorney to try to identify the big bad actors that are really wreaking havoc in St. Louis. And they're trying to come together with their resources and targeting to see if they can't successfully get those folks off the street, which would make a big difference for many African American families that are living in fear in their neighborhoods and have no choice about where they can live.
It's been quite a year in that regard so far this year. Senator McCaskill, I know your time is limited, and I want to thank you so much for being with us. I look forward to seeing you over the weekend when you'll be back to promote the book, Plenty Ladylike.
Yeah, Saturday night at the public library. And I want to mention, Don, that the extra on the ticket for that goes to the literacy program at the St. Louis County Library. So it's also a good cause, and I hope everybody comes out and we have a great conversation. I know we will, and I look forward to seeing you then.
I look forward to seeing you, and thank you so much for being with us this time, Senator Claire McCaskill. Let me just repeat all of what the senator has just said to make sure everybody knows that she'll be here this weekend for a discussion and book signing at the St. Louis County Library headquarters on Lindbergh. It's at 7 o'clock. It's my pleasure to conduct an onstage interview there before she takes questions from the audience. That's Saturday at 7 at the St. Louis County Library headquarters. When we come back, how the Ferguson story has impacted businesses there. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.